However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard.
Black Tuesday.
The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
will revive and will prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful is because the economic system is so strong. and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the US left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the U.S. and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. If you have questions and comments you'd like to share with us, just email or visit our Facebook or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We're trying to look at the human beings and see how can one become the perfect human being in terms of human rights, in terms of dealing with other people, because obviously there are certain things or traits or characteristics that I and you need to have in order to deal with our fellow human beings. So in the previous episode, we mentioned that overall, one needs to be pure and try to filter anything bad from himself and create himself and present himself in a way where there is no harm that will come from him towards other people. The other thing that we mentioned is that human beings, to be perfect, we need to start thinking of one another. And believe me, thinking of one another, as easy as it may sound, but it's extremely difficult. We fail at 99% of the times in this. Because thinking of others means that when you see your brother in need, you give him whatever you have just to make sure he's okay. How many of us do that? I can speak for myself. I don't do that. But human beings are human beings. Now, another thing that we want to talk about today in terms of being a good, perfect human being in terms of dealing with other people is we need to be lenient. And leniency here means so many things. Like, but generally speaking, being lenient with people in the way we talk, in the way we express, in the way that we debate, in the way we discuss, in the way, even the way we fight, the way, even the way we joke with one another. Amir al-Mu'mineen gives a perfect example of that, of how we should be. He says, لا تكن لينا فتعصر. Don't be like a sponge and then you will be squeezed out. ولا صلبا فتكسر. And don't be so hard that you can be broken. So there has to be a middle line. There has to be this leniency when we are doing with one another. Even, like I said, to begin with, having a smile on our faces when we see other people, joking around with them, making them comfortable, making them happy, is also one of the traits and virtues of a believer that needs to have. Because some people, when you look at their faces, you really start to hate yourself. Like you say, you know what? I don't want to be around these people. If we look at the akhlaq of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the Imams alayhi wa sallam, even them, they used to joke around. Obviously, halal jokes, not stupid, rude, or haram jokes that we do these days. So you see, they are very flexible, very lenient, and even when they are, you know, they face harm from other people, they take it lightly, you know, and they pretend as nothing has happened. So a mu'min, when it comes to his other fellow human beings, he needs to maintain that leniency in everything, mind you, because like I said, we can go to the specifics and that will take us to a different direction and different topic altogether. But being lenient in dealing with them, being lenient in being with them, being lenient in, I don't know, sharing and what have you. So leniency is required in me and you in order to deal with our fellow human beings. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We want to be the perfect human beings in terms of dealing with one another. So we mentioned a number of things that we need to have. Among the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from me and you is what we call istiqama, being on the straight and righteous path when it comes to dealing with other people. when we talk about being on the right path, especially in terms of not trying to put too much effort and make other people do everything for us while we sit and enjoy and not care. There has to be a sense of responsibility, a shared responsibility between me and my other fellow human beings, or at least my brothers in faith. So when I need help, I can surely ask others to help me. But I should not bring others to do my work for me. Because sometimes we put all our responsibilities on other people. I'll give you an example. That's something that we can relate to. For example, in terms of study, right? So I go around asking people to do my assignment for me, my essay for me, to do my thesis for me, while I just sit and do nothing. Sometimes I ask people to come help me with something, and then I let them do everything while I sit and watch. So this is not required. You know, we need to be fair. We need to be at least have a bit of independence ourselves and not rely on other people. Because relying on others, it means that I am taking their time. I'm taking their effort. Sometimes I could be even taking them money. Sometimes I'm depriving them of quality time with their families. Why? Because I don't have that independency myself. Like I said, sometimes as human beings, we are not perfect. We don't have all the equipments and all the tools required to maintain our lives. So we will need help. But in needing help, it has to be done in a proportion. It has to be, there's a middle ground that I don't go to ifrat or tafrit, to go in excess or to go less. So keeping it balanced. So especially when it comes to other people, that's a trait the people of the righteous path, those who go on the straight path, need to maintain when it comes to other people, to have a bit of independency themselves, to depend more on themselves, to do things more themselves, to try to accomplish their tasks themselves by themselves, and not to rely heavily or mainly on other people, because they are human beings just like me and you, and they have duties. And I'm very sure you can think of examples where a friend of yours or someone that you know that wants you to do everything for them while they just sit and do nothing, or they want your help in everything even though they can do it themselves, or at least they can learn to do it themselves, but they just refuse to do so. They are more happy and lazy, I should say, to let others do the work for them, and they don't do that. So in order for us to help other people and become perfect human beings, we need to maintain that straight line, that path of righteousness and that balance, and become more independent ourselves. We'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
In the limelight.
Climate emergency is just a rhetoric by Western regimes. This claim is evidenced by these regimes' disregard for the climate emergency and warnings against fossil fuel exploration. In a new move, the UK has opened up a new licensing round to allow oil and gas companies to explore for fossil fuels in the North Sea despite threats of a legal battle from climate campaigners. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, climate campaigners have recently condemned the UK's announcement that it will open up a new licensing round for oil and gas fields in the North Sea, saying the decision signifies the Conservative government's blatant disregard for the climate emergency and warnings against fossil fuel exploration from energy experts and scientists. Claiming new oil and gas drilling will not undermine the country's stated plan to cut its carbon emissions to net zero by 2050. The North Sea Transition Authority, NSTA, said it will issue up to 100 licenses for nearly 900 exploration areas, including several that are known to contain hydrocarbons. In response to Climate Minister Graham Stewart's claim that the plan is actually good for the environment because using fossil fuels in the North Sea negates the need for foreign gas, friends of the SFOE Scotland accused the UK government of sticking two fingers up to climate scientists and energy experts. By encouraging greedy fossil fuel companies to keep looking for more fossil fuels, the UK government is denying the reality of the climate emergency, said Freya Atchison, an oil and gas campaigner for the group, adding, instead of new fossil fuels, we urgently need a transition to an energy system powered by renewables and a mass rollout of energy efficiency measures to reduce energy demand. With the cost of living skyrocketing due to the volatile prices of oil and gas, it's obvious that the UK current energy system is completely unfit for purpose, serving only to make oil company bosses and shareholders richer, while everyone else loses out, the campaigner said. The crisis in Eastern Europe has sent energy prices soaring for households across Europe, but the Climate Action Campaign, Paid to Pollute, warned that licensing oil and gas fields in the North Sea will do nothing to alleviate the cost of living crisis. The plan is moving forward under the pretext of energy security, a campaigner for the group said in a video posted to social media, but another North Sea licensing round won't deliver UK energy security. He continued, the North Sea is an aging and oil-heavy basin. The bold truth? The UK has burnt most of its gas. Any new gas that is found won't be produced for years and years. As the UK Committee on Climate Change said earlier this year, it takes an average of about 28 years for oil and gas production to begin from the time an exploration license is issued. UK Green Party co-leader Adrian Ramsay called the news of the latest licensing round deeply distressing. The government's claim that burning ever more fossil fuels from the North Sea will help the UK meet its international obligations to become net zero by 2050 has no connection to reality, Ramsay said on social media. The new licenses are being offered nearly a year after grassroots campaigners were credited with pressuring Shell Oil to put out of a plan to drill in the proposed Cambo oil field in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland's Shetland Islands. FOE Scotland called on a Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, who opposed the Cambo proposal, to stand up to the NSTA's reckless plans to expand fossil fuels in the North Sea. A campaigner said these announcements risk locking us into a climate-destroying energy system for decades to come. entrenching reliance on this volatile energy in places like Aberdeen and leaving people all across Scotland exposed to rocketing energy bills.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The battered town of Obeznoi. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone. Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians. A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian centre. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. indeed most in Donbass, expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Janimir Rebeznoy, Donbass.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people.
Following the failure to renew the UN brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The olive harvest season has begun in the Gaza Strip, and farmers are picking olives on their land in order to provide for their families. Palestinian farmers and their families leave their everyday routines in the middle of October and dedicate some of their time to pick the fruits of nearly a year of hard work and special care. The olive harvest season runs until early November. The tiny coastal territory used to have a thriving olive industry, but it has suffered a major setback due to years of Israeli blockade and wars, as well as the systematic destruction of olive trees. The state of Gaza's olive farmers reflects the scope of human rights violations committed by the Israeli regime against thousands of Palestinian farmers. Israel's tight restrictions have been preventing farmers from acquiring badly needed equipment for irrigation and planting.
The situation is very difficult, especially for olive farmers. It takes many years to grow olive trees, and the Israeli blockade has made it extremely difficult for us to get fertilizers and badly needed farming equipment.
The annual olive harvest season is considered a key economic, social, and cultural event for Palestinians. Olive and agriculture in general have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Farmers here are struggling to keep this vital sector alive. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
There was no mention of peace talks to end the conflict in Ukraine as NATO defense ministers met in Brussels on Thursday. Spain, one of 30 NATO countries, has pledged to supply Kiev with advanced air defense systems.
This comes on top of what other allies have delivered over the last few days. I thank all allies for their significant contributions, and I urge them to continue to step up.
Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, attended the meeting in Brussels. While he's in Belgium, who's running things back in Kiev? It's a question we put to one expert during an online interview.
The Americans, because the Americans said we are offering intelligence information, we are coordinating the flow of weapons. They direct the battlefield. They have satellites under the disposal of their military.
NATO says it has doubled the number of its battle groups in eastern regions of the alliance. More than 30 warships are patrolling the Baltic Sea and North Sea. Critics say this steady build-up in recent years is designed to provoke Russia and keep NATO relevant while pumping trillions into the arms industry. NATO's Article 5 states that an attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all of its members.
The United States is absolutely committed to its Article 5 commitments, and we are committed to defending every inch of NATO's territory, if and when it comes to that.
NATO says Russia's nuclear forces are being closely monitored. The alliance confirms it's going ahead with nuclear war deterrence exercises next week, dubbed Steadfast Noon. The drills will involve nuclear-capable aircraft, but apparently will not include any live bombs. Asked if the timing is bad given heightened tensions, NATO boss Jens Stoltenberg said it would send out the wrong signal if the exercises were suddenly cancelled now. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British government started the week with a big question hanging over its head: how to fund its billions of pounds worth of tax cuts announced last month. While it continues to tout the benefits of its controversial growth plan, in the real world, the central bank has had to intervene a third time to try to stabilize the financial markets less than 2 weeks after Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng's announcement of his mini-budget sparked market turmoil and blistering political attacks.
Will the Chancellor now put aside his pride, do the right thing for our country, end this trickle-down nonsense and reverse the budget?
The response from the finance minister, defiant, despite his recent U-turn on tax cuts for the highest earners.
She should get her facts right. The IMF today have said that our growth is going up.
What the IMF has also said is that high levels of inflation will persist longer in Britain than in almost all other advanced economies.
The answer they're going to try and give to this is to say, actually get the economy to grow. But it's very difficult to get the economy to grow if the rest of the world economy is actually shrinking at the moment. So if we're by cutting taxes, they say we'll get things going. Well, actually, at the moment, what they're trying to do is actually slow the economy down to control inflation. That's what the Bank of England's doing. But the government is moving in the opposite direction and adding inflation to it. This doesn't make sense to us.
The Chancellor hasn't made it clear where the cuts will fall. The National Health Service has the largest budget, but cutting that isn't realistic. The Prime Minister is committed to increase defense spending, which leaves other areas, such as education and welfare, looking vulnerable again.
Well, that was done before, when we had to go through a period of austerity, and that was very unpopular indeed. If they're going to go through that again, they're going to be very unpopular, and it's not going to be accepted, I don't think. So it's going to be interesting to see which bit they're going to try and cut. Or are they really just going to bank on growth, in which case we can't see how they're going to do it.
More than 24 million Britons live on some sort of benefit. A further reduction is unthinkable.
The UK economy shrank unexpectedly in August. Inflation is at nearly 10%, interest rates are up, pension funds are on the brink, faith in the government shaken. And with the Bank of England's intervention in the markets ending this week, is another U-turn by the government in the offing. Saeed Purza, London.
A general strike and civil disobedience have been observed in occupied East Al-Quds and in many areas of the occupied West Bank to reject Israel's siege on Shafat refugee camp and Anata town northeast Al-Quds. Since Saturday, the Israeli military has kept over 130,000 Palestinians in the two areas under forced lockdown after sealing all military checkpoints. The siege has disrupted residents' vital interests. It has prevented them from accessing the rest of the city for work, school and medical care and other necessities in severe violation of their basic rights. Israeli military says the move comes as they are searching for a Palestinian gunman who killed an Israeli female soldier at a checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat on Saturday.
What goes on in these actions by the Palestinians are a normal response to the Israeli brutality and aggression against Shafat refugee camp and Anata town. The strike is meant to lift the siege imposed on Shafat and Anata, Al-Quds, Qalandia refugee camp, and other towns. We all responded to the call of civil disobedience and strike.
Also on Wednesday, the Israeli forces imposed a closure on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead near an illegal settlement in the area. In addition to the major military checkpoints surrounding the city, dirt mounds have been placed on the Nablus area roads by military bulldozers to prevent Palestinians to use alternative exits. A manhunt is still underway to find the shooter. Israeli media revealed that the military was considering launching a large-scale operation in the northern West Bank in a bid to end the recent phenomena in struggle, armed struggle.
The resistance of the Palestinian people, and especially the armed resistance, as it happened in Jenin, and it moved to Nablus, and now from Nablus, we hope that it will be spreading all over the West Bank in order to resist this occupation. The phenomena that we are witnessing today in Nablus, this is the new way for the Palestinians to express their anger of this occupation, especially and particularly that all other political solutions is totally failed.
In recent months, the Israeli army have launched near daily raids to the West Bank, mainly in Jenin and Nablus, where Palestinian armed resistance is becoming more organized and new groups of fighters have been formed, the most popular now known as the Lion's Den.
Despite Tel Aviv's heavy-handed crackdown and collective punishment of Palestinians, they are keeping up their resistance against the regime using different tools. Every day, the Palestinians prove that the Israeli military's aggressive measures have failed to weaken their struggle. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The EU's Temporary Protection Directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the Temporary Protection Directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a job. There is in-work homelessness, but there is also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a ninth round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
All these steps, especially by the Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas and, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters.
Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran.
From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites.